Side 5. Death is a Lonely Business, continuing on page 199. They were all there, and they all spoke with great honesty and clarity. There were no lies. A true grief lay just beneath every word that was said. In the midst of the hot afternoon, someone touched my elbow. I turned and was surprised. "Henry, how'd you get here?"
"I sure didn't walk."
"How'd you find me in all this mob?" I whispered.
"You're the only Ivory Soap. The rest is Chanel and Old Spice. I'm sure glad I'm blind on a day like this. Don't mind listening, but I surely do not want to see this."
The tributes continued. Mr. Fox, Louis B. Mayer's lawyer, was next, a man who knew law, but who rarely went to see any of the films they made. Right now, he remembered early days in Chicago when Fanny... A hummingbird darted among the bright colors. A dragonfly hummed by soon after.
"Armpits," said Henry quietly.
Startled, I waited and whispered,
"Armpits?"
"On the street outside the tenement," whispered Henry, staring at a sky he could not see, speaking from the corner of his mouth.
"Inside, the halls, by my room, by Fanny's room, the smell, him, the one."
A pause, a nod.
"Armpits."
My nose twitched. My eyes began to run. I stirred my feet, wanting to get away, go see, find.
"When was this, Henry?" I whispered.
"The other night. Night Fanny went away forever."
"Shh,"
said someone nearby. Henry shut up. When there was a change of speakers, I whispered,
"Where?"
"Crossing the street early on," said Henry. "At night. Powerful, real powerful smell. Then later, seemed to me the armpits came into the hall behind me. I mean, it was so strong it cleared my sinuses. Like having a grizzly bear breathe on you. You ever smell that? I froze half across the street like I'd been hit with a baseball bat. Thought anyone smells like that's got a grudge against God, dogs, mankind, the world. Step on a cat rather than walk around. Badass mean. Armpits, like I said.
Armpits.
That help you any?" My whole body was frozen. I could only nod. Henry said, "That smell's been around the halls some few nights now. But just got stronger is all. Maybe because that dumb son of a bitch was getting closer. I was tripped up by Mr. Smell. I know that now. I got it figured."
"Shh,"
said someone. An actor spoke, and a priest, and a rabbi. And then the Hall Johnson Choir from the First Baptist Church on Central Avenue filed through the tombstones and gathered to sing "Great Day in the Morning," "In the Sweet By and By," and "Dear God, Join Me When I'm Gone." And their voices were the voices I had heard in the late 30s, chanting Ronald Coleman over the snow peaks and down into Shangri-La, or standing on white clouds in the fields of the Lord in green pastures. By the end of their radiant singing, I was overflowed and joyed, and death had had a new coat of sunlight and time, and the hummingbird came back for nectar, and the dragonfly sank down to scan my face and go away. "That," said Crumley, on the way out of the graveyard, with Henry walking between us, "is the way I want to be sung out of the world. God, I'd love to be that whole damn choir. Who needs money when you can sing like that?" But I was staring at Henry. He felt my stare.
"Thing is," said Henry, "he keeps coming back. Armpits. You'd think he'd had enough, sure. But he's hungry mean. Can't stop. Scaring people is like crackerjack to him. Hurts his byword. Pain is a living. He figures to get old Henry like he got the rest. But I won't fall again."
Crumley was listening with some seriousness.
"If Armpits comes again, I'll call you a mediamente. He's fiddling around the rooms. Caught him fiddling Fanny's locked door. It's padlocked and pasted over by the law, right? He was fiddling it, and I yelled him off. He's a coward, for sure. Got no weapons, just goes around putting his foot out so blind men take a whole flight of steps in one jump. Armpits," I yelled. "Scat!"
"Call us," said Crumley. "Can we give you a lift?"
Some of the ugly ladies from the tenement brought me, thanks, and will take me home.
Henry, I said. I put out my hand. He took it swiftly. It was almost as if he had seen it coming. How do I smell, Henry? I said. Henry sniffed and laughed. They don't make heroes like they used to, but you'll do.
Driving back toward the beach with Crumley, I saw a big limousine pass us at 70 miles an hour, putting a lot of space between it and the flowered graveyard. I waved and yelled. Constance Radigan did not even glance over. She had been at the graveside somewhere, hidden away to one side, and now she was roaring home, angry at Fanny for leaving us all, and maybe angry with me for somehow bringing death to present a bill. Her limousine vanished in a great white-gray cloud of exhaust.
The Harpies and the Furies just screamed by, observed Crumley.
No, I said, only a lost lady running to hide. I tried calling Constance Radigan during the next 3 days, but she wouldn't answer. She was brooding and mad. Somehow, in some dumb way, I was in cahoots with the man who stood in halls and did terrible things to people. I tried calling Mexico City, but Peg was off, lost forever, I was sure. I prowled around Venice, staring and listening and sniffing, hoping for that dreadful voice, searching for the terrible smell of something dying or long dead. Even Crumley was gone. I stared, but he was nowhere up ahead, following. At the end of 3 days of failed phone calls, unmet killers, furious with fate and confounded by funerals, I did what I had never done before. Around 10 o'clock at night, I strode down the empty pier, not knowing where I was going until I got there.
Hey,
someone said. I yanked a rifle up off the shelf, and without checking to see if it was loaded or if anything was in the way, I fired it, fired it, fired it 16 times. Wham, wham. And wham, wham, and wham, wham, and someone was yelling. I didn't hit any of the targets. I had never handled a rifle in my life. I don't know what I was shooting at, but yes, I did. Take that, you son of a bitch! Take that, you bastard! Wham, wham, and wham, wham! The rifle was empty, but I kept yanking the trigger. I suddenly knew it was impotent. Someone took the rifle away from me. Annie Oakley. Staring at me as if she had never seen me before.
"Do you know what you're doing?" she asked.
"No, and I don't give a damn." I glanced around.
"How come you're open so late?"
"Nothing else to do. I can't sleep."
"What's wrong with you, mister?"
"Everybody in the whole damn world is going to be dead by this time next week."
"You don't believe that?"
"No, but it feels like it. Give me another rifle."
"You don't want to shoot any more."
"Yes, I do. And I haven't money to pay. You'll have to trust me," I cried. She stared at me for a long time. Then she handed me a rifle.
"Sock 'em, cowboy. Kill 'em, bogey," she said.
I fired 16 times. This time I hit 2 targets by mistake, even though I couldn't see them. My glasses were that fogged.
"Had enough?"
asked Annie Oakley quietly behind me.
"No!"
I shouted. Then I said, lower.
"Yes."
"What are you doing outside the gallery on the boardwalk?"
"I was afraid I'd get shot in there. Some maniac just unloaded 2 rifles without aiming."
We looked at each other and I began to laugh. She listened and said,
"Are you laughing or crying?"
"What's it sound like? I got to do something. Tell me what." She studied my face for a long time, and then she went around shutting off the running ducks and the bobbing clowns and the lights. A door opened in the back of the gallery. She was silhouetted there. She said,
"If you've got to shoot at anything, here's the target."
And she was gone. It was a full half minute before I realized she expected me to follow.
"Do you behave this way often?"
asked Annie Oakley. "Sorry," I said. I was on one far side of her bed, she on the other, listening to me talk about Mexico City and Peg and Mexico City, so far away it was a dreadful ache. "The
the story of my life, said Annie Oakley. Is men in bed with me bored silly, or talking about other women, or lighting cigarettes, or rushing off in their cars when I go to the bathroom? You know what my real name is? Lucretia Isabel Clarice Annabel Maria Monica Brown. My mom gave me all those. So what do I choose? Annie Oakley. Problem is, I'm dumb. Men can't stand me after the first 10 minutes. Dumb. Read a book, an hour later it's gone. Nothing sticks. I talk a lot, don't I? A bit, I said gently. You'd think some guy would like someone as truly dumb as me, but I wear them out. 300 nights a year it's some damn different male goof lying where you're lying, and that damn foghorn blowing out in the bay. Does it get to you? Some nights, even with a jerk of a cluck in bed with me when that foghorn goes off, I feel so alone, and there he is checking his keys, looking at the door. Her telephone rang. She grabbed it, listened, and said, I'll be damned. She waved it at me. For you. Impossible, I said. No one knows I'm here. I took the phone.
What are you doing at her place? Said Constance Rattigan.
Nothing. How did you find me?
Someone called. Just a voice. Told me to check on you and hung up.
Oh, my God. I was turning cold.
Get out of there, said Constance. I need your help. Your strange friend has come to visit.
My friend? The ocean roared under the rifle gallery, shuddering the room and the bed.
Down by the shore, 2 nights in a row. You've got to come scare him off. Oh, God!
Constance! There was a long silence, in which I could hear the surf outside Constance Rattigan's windows. Then she said in a strange, numb way,
He's there now.
Don't let him see you.
The bastard is down on the shoreline, just where he was last night. He just stares up at the house like he's waiting for me. The bastard's naked. What does he think? The old lady is so crazy she'll run out and jump him? Christ.
Shut the windows, Constance. Turn off the lights.
No. He's backing off. Maybe my voice carries. Maybe he thinks I'm calling the police.
Call them.
Gone.
Constance took a deep breath.
Get over here, kid. Fast.
She didn't hang up. She just let the phone drop and walked off. I could hear her sandals slapping the tiled floor, making typewriter sounds. I didn't hang up either. For some reason, I just put the phone down as if it were an umbilical cord between me and Constance Rattigan. As long as I didn't disconnect, she couldn't die. I could still hear the night tide moving on her end of the line.
Just like all the other men. There you go, said a voice.
I turned. Annie Oakley sat up in bed, huddled in her sheets like an abandoned manatee.
Don't hang up that telephone, I said.
Not until I reach the far end, I thought, and save a life.
Dumb, said Annie Oakley.
That's why you're going.
Dumb.
It took a lot of guts to run the night shore toward Constance Rattigan's. I imagined some terrible dead man rushing the other way.
Jesus, I gasped. What happens if I meet him?
Gah!
I shrieked.
And ran full tilt into a solid shadow.
Thank God it's you,
someone yelled.
No, Constance, I said. Thank God it's you.
What's damn funny?
This.
I slapped the big bright pillows on all sides of me. This is the second bed I've been in tonight.
Hilarious, said Constance. Mind if I bust your nose?
Constance. Peg's my girl. I was just lonely. You haven't called in days. Annie asked me for pillow talk, and that's all it was. I can't lie. It shows in my face. Look. Constance looked and laughed.
Christ, fresh apple pie. Okay, okay.
She sank back.
I scare the hell out of you just now.
You should have yelled ahead as you ran.
I was glad to see you, son. Sorry I haven't phoned. Once I forgot funerals in a few hours. Now it takes days.
She touched a switch. The lights dimmed, and the 16-millimeter projector flashed on. Two cowboys knocked each other down on the white wall. How can you watch films at a time like this? I said.
To rev me up so I can go out and knock Mr. Naked's block off if he shows again tomorrow night.
Don't even joke about it. I looked out the French windows at the empty shore where only white waves sounded on the edge of night. Do you think he telephoned you to tell you where I was, with Annie, and then walked up the beach to stand out there?
No. His voice wasn't right. It's got to be two different guys. Christ, I can't figure it, but the one guy, the one with no clothes, he's got to be some sort of exhibitionist, a flasher, right? Or why doesn't he just run up in here and ruin the old lady, or kill her, or both? It's the other one, the guy on the phone, that gives me the willies.
I know, I thought. I've heard his breathing.
He sounds like a real monster, said Constance.
Yes, I thought. A long way off, I heard the big red trolley shriek around an iron curve in the rain, with the voice behind me chanting the words of a title for Crumley's book. Constance, I said, and stopped. I was going to tell her I had seen the stranger on the shore many nights ago.
I've got some real estate south of here, said Constance. I'm going to go check it tomorrow. Call me late, yes? And meantime, you want to look into something for me?
Anything. Well, almost anything. Constance watched William Farnham knock his brother Dustin down, pick him up, knock him down again.
I think I know who Mr. Naked on the Shore is.
Who? She searched down along the surf as if his ghost was still there.
A son of a bitch from my past, with a head like a mean German general, she said, and a body like all the boys of summer who ever lived.
The small motorbike pulled up outside the carousel building with a young man in swim shorts astride, his body bronzed and oiled and beautiful. He was wearing a heavy helmet with a dark visor down over his face to his chin, so I couldn't see his face. But the body was the most amazing I think I have ever seen. It made me think of a day years before, when I had seen a beautiful Apollo walking along the shore with a surf of young boys walking after him, drawn, for they knew not what reasons, but they walked in beauty with him, loving, but not knowing it was love, never daring to name and trying not to think of this moment later in life. There are beauties like that in this world. And all men and all women and all children are pulled in their wake, and it is all pure and wondrous and clean, and there is no residue of guilt because nothing happened. You just saw and followed, and when the time on the shore was over, he went away and you went off, smiling the kind of smile that is such a surprise you put your hand up an hour later and find it still attached. On a whole beach in an entire summer, you only see bodies like that on some young man or some young woman once. Twice, if the gods are snoozing and not jealous. Here was Apollo astride the motorbike, gazing through his dark, featureless visor at me.
You come to see the old man?
The laugh behind the glass was rich and throaty.
Good. Come on.
He propped the bike and was in and up the stairs ahead of me. Like a gazelle, he took the steps three at a time and vanished into an upstairs room. I followed, one step at a time, feeling old. When I got to his room, I heard the shower running. A moment later, he came out, stripped and glistening with water, the helmet still over his head. He stood in the bathroom door, looking into me as he might into a mirror, and liking what he saw.
Well, he said inside his helmet, how do you like the most beautiful boy, the young man that I love?
I blushed furiously.
He laughed and shucked off his helmet.
My God, I said, it really is you.
The old man, said John Wilkes Hopwood.
He glanced down at his body and smiled.
Or the young. Which of us do you prefer?
I swallowed hard. I had to force myself to speak quickly, for I wanted to run back down the stairs before he closed and locked me in the room. "That all depends," I said, "on which one of you has been standing on the beach late nights outside Constance Radigan's home." With wondrous timing, the calliope downstairs in the rotunda started up, running the carousel. It sounded like a dragon that had swallowed a corps of bagpipers and was now trying to throw them back up in no particular order to no particular tune. Like a cat that wants time to consider its next move, old young Hopwood turned his tanned backside toward me, a signal that was supposed to fascinate. I shut my eyes to the golden sight. That gave Hopwood a moment to decide what he wanted to say. "What makes you think I would bother with an old horse like Constance Radigan?" he said, as he reached into the bathroom and dragged out a towel, which he now used to swab his shoulders and chest. "You were the great love of her life. She was yours. That was the summer all America loved the lovers, yes?" He turned to check on how much irony might show in my face to match my voice. "Have you come here because she sent you to warn me off?" "Perhaps." "How many push-ups can you do? Can you do 60 laps of a pool, or bike 40 miles in a day without sweating? What weights can you lift, and how many people..." I noticed he did not say women. "Can you bed in one afternoon?" he asked. "No, no, 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 and maybe two," I said, to answer all those questions. "Then," said Helmut the Hun, turning to show me Antinous's magnificent facade, something to match the golden hind, "you are in no position to threaten me, ya?" His mouth was a razor slit from which bursts of bright shark teeth hissed and chewed. "I will come and go on the beach," he said. With the Gestapo ahead and the summer boys soon after, I thought, "I admit nothing. Perhaps I was there some nights," he nodded up the coast. "Perhaps not." You could have cut your wrists with his smile. He hurled the towel at me. I caught it. "Get my back for me, will you?" I hurled the towel away. It fell and hung over his head, masking his face. The horrible Hun was, for a moment, gone. Only Sun King Apollo, his rump as bright as the apples of the gods, remained. From under the towel, his voice said quietly, "The interview is over." "Did it ever really begin?" I said. I went downstairs as the dragon's sick calliope music was coming up. There were no words at all on the Venice Cinema marquee. All the letters were gone. I read the emptiness half a dozen times, feeling something roll over and die in my chest. I went around trying all the doors, which were locked, and looked into the box office, which was deserted, and glanced at the big poster frames where Barrymore and Chaney and Norma Shearer had smiled just a few nights ago. Now, nothing. I backed off and read the emptiness a last time to myself, quietly. "How do you like the double bill?" asked a voice from behind me. I turned. Mr. Shapeshade was there, beaming. He handed over a big roll of theater posters. I knew what it was. My diplomas from Nosferatu Institute, Graduate School of Quasimodo, postgraduate in D'Artagnan and Robin Hood. "Mr. Shapeshade, you can't give these to me. You're a romantic sap, aren't you?"
"Sure, but..."
Take. Farewell, goodbye. But another farewell, goodbye, out beyond. Come and zip here, out." He left the diplomas in my hands and trotted off. I found him at the end of the pier, pointing down and watching my face to see me crumple and seize the pier rail, staring over. The rifles were down there, silent for the first time in years. They lay on the sea bottom about 15 feet under, but the water was clear because the sun was coming out. I counted maybe a dozen long, cold, blue metal weapons down there where the fish swam by. "Some farewell, huh?" Shapeshade glanced where I was looking. "One by one. One by one. Early this morning, I came running up, yelled, 'What are you doing?' 'What does it look like?' she said. And one by one, over and down. They're closing your place. They're closing mine this afternoon. So what the hell, she said. And one by one, she didn't, I said, then stopped. I searched the waters under the pier and far out. She didn't. Was she the last one in? No, no. Just stood here a long time with me watching the ocean. They won't be here long, she said. Week from now, gone. A bunch of stupid guys will dive and bring them up, yes? What could I say? Yes. She leave any word when she went? I could not take my eyes off the long rifles that shone in the flowing tide. Said she was going somewhere to milk cows, but no bulls, she said, no bulls. Milk cows and churned butter was the last thing I heard. I hope she will, I said. The rifles suddenly swarmed with fish who seemed to have come to see, but there were no sounds of firing. Their silence, said Shapeshade, is nice, eh? I nodded. Don't forget these, said Shapeshade. They had fallen out of my hands. He picked up and handed me my diplomas for all the years of my young life running up and down popcorn aisles in the dark with the Phantom and the Hunchback. On the way back, I passed a little boy who stood staring down at the remains of the roller coaster lying like strewn bones on the shore. "What's that dinosaur doing lying there dead on the beach?" he said. I had thought of it first. I resented this boy who saw the collapsed roller coaster as I saw it. A beast dead in the tides. No, I wanted to yell at him. But aloud I said gently, Oh, Lord, son, I wish I knew. I turned and staggered away, carrying an armload of invisible rifles down the pier. I had two dreams that night. In the first, A.L. Schrank's Sigmund Freud Schopenhauer tarot card shop was knocked to flinders by the great hungry steam shovel. So often the tide floated the Marquis de Sade and Thomas de Quincey and Mark Twain's sick daughters and Sartre on a truly bad day, drowning in the dark waters over the shine of the shooting gallery rifles. The second dream was a newsreel I had seen of the Russian royal family lined up by their graves. And shot, so that they jerked and jumped like a silent film projection, knocked, blown away, end over end, like popped corks, into the pit. It made you gasp with horrid laughter. Inhuman. Hilarious. Bam. There went Sam, Jimmy, Pietro, Canary Lady, Fanny, Cal, Old Lion Cage Man, Constance, Shrank, Crumley, Peg, and me. Bam! I slammed awake, sweating ice. The telephone across the street in the gas station was ringing. It stopped. I held my breath. It rang again once and stopped. I waited. It rang again once and stopped. Oh, God, I thought. Peg wouldn't do that. Crumley wouldn't do that. Ring once and stop? The phone rang again, once, then silence. It's him, Mr. Lonely Death, calling to tell me things I don't want to know. I sat up. The hairs on my body fuzzed as if Cal had run his bumblebee electric barber shears down my neck to strike a nerve. I dressed and ran out to the shoreline. I took a deep breath, then stared south. Far away down the coast, all of the windows in Constance Radigan's Moorish fort were brightly lit. Constance, I thought, Fanny won't like this. Fanny. And then I really ran. I came in from the surf like death himself. Every light in Constance's place was burning, and every door stood wide open, as if she had opened them all to let nature and the world and night and the wind in to clean her place while she was gone. And she was gone. I knew without even going in her place, because there was a long line of her footprints coming down to the tide line where I stopped and looked to see where they went in the water, but never came out. I wasn't surprised. I was surprised that I wasn't surprised. I walked up to her wide-open front door and didn't call, or almost called for her chauffeur, and laughed to think I might have been so foolish, and went in without touching anything. The phonograph was playing in the Arabian parlor, dance music by Ray Noble from London in 1934, some Noel Coward tunes. I let the music play. The projector was on, mindlessly whirling its reel, the film done, the white light of the bulb staring at the blank front wall. I didn't think to turn it off. A bottle of Moët et Chandon stood iced and waiting, as if she had gone down to the sea expecting to bring some golden god of the deep back with her. Cheeses were laid out on a plate on a pillow, along with a shaker of martinis, getting watery. The Duesenberg was in the garage, and the footprints still lay in the sand, going only one way. I telephoned Crumley and congratulated myself on not crying just yet, feeling numb. "Crumley," I said into the telephone. "Crumley." "Crum," I said. "Child of the night," he said. "You bet on another wrong horse again?" I told him where I was. "I can't walk very well." I sat down suddenly, clenching the phone. "Come get me." Crumley met me on the shore. We stood looking up at that Arabian fort, all brightly lit like a festive tent in the middle of a desert of sand. The door opening out on the shore was still wide, and the music was playing inside, a stack of records that seemed never to want to stop dropping. It was Lilac Time. Then it was Diane. Then it was Ain't She Sweet, followed by Hear My Song of the Nile, and then Pagan Love Song. I expected Raymond Navarro to show up at any moment, run in and come out wild-haired and mad of eye, rushing down to the shore. But there's just me and Crumley. Huh? I didn't know I was thinking out loud, I apologized. We trudged up the shore. You touch anything? Only the phone. When we reached the door, I let him go in and prowl through the house and come out. Where's the chauffeur? That's something else I never told you. There never was one. What? I told him about Constance Radigan and her role-playing. She was her own all-star cast, huh? Jesus. Louder and funnier, as they say. We went back out to stand on the wind-blown porch to look at the footprints that were beginning to blow away. Could be suicide, said Crumley. Constance wouldn't do that. Christ, you're so god-awful sure about people. Why don't you grow up? Just because you like someone doesn't mean they can't take the big jump without you. There was someone on the shore waiting for her. Proof. We followed Constance's single line of prints down to the surf. He was standing over there, I pointed. Two nights. I saw him. Swell. Ankle deep in water. So no prints for the killer. What else do you want to show me, son? Someone called me an hour ago, woke me up, told me to come along the beach. That someone knew her house was empty or soon going to be. Phone call, huh? Swell again. Now you're ankle deep in water and no prints. That the whole story? My cheeks must have reddened. He saw that I had been telling a half-truth. I didn't want to admit I hadn't answered the phone the last time, but ran down the beach on a terrible hunch. At least you've got integrity, scribe. Crumley looked at the white waves combing in, then at the footprints, then at the house, white, cold, and empty in the middle of the night. You know what integrity means? Based on the word integers. Numbers. Integrity means to add up. It has nothing to do with virtue. Hitler had integrity. 0 + 0 + 0 makes 0. No score. Phone calls and footprints underwater and blind hunches and dopey faith. These late-night shootings are beginning to tell on me. That about do it?
No, damn it! I've got a real-life suspect. Constance recognized him. I did, too. Went to see him. Find out where he was tonight. You got the killer. You...
I lost control of my voice. I had to take my glasses off and wipe the tiny wet salt marks off so I could see. Crumley patted my cheek, then said, "Hey, don't. How do you know this guy, whoever he is, didn't take her in the water and
drown her?
Swim with her. Talk nice." And they swam north 100 yards and walked back to his place. For all you know, she'll be dragging home at dawn with a funny smile on her face.
"No,"
I said. "What, am I spoiling the mysterious romance of all this for you?"
"No."
But he could tell I was uncertain. He touched my elbow. "What else haven't you said?" "Constance mentioned she had some real estate not far from here down the coast." "You sure she just didn't go there tonight?" "If what you say's true, what if she got spooked, pulled up stakes?" "Her limousine's still here. People walk, you know. You do it all the time. Lady could walk a mile south, spooked in an inch of water, and us no wiser." I looked south to see if I could see a beautiful lady escaped along the strand. "Thing is," said Crumley, "we got nothing to go on. Empty house, old records playing. No suicide note, no sign of violence. We got to wait for her to come back. And if she doesn't, there's still no case, no corpus delicti. I bet you a bucket of beer she'll..."
"Let me take you to the upstairs apartment at the Carousel tomorrow. When you see that strange man's face..."
"God, do you mean who I think you mean?"
I nodded.
"The airy fairy," said Crumley. "The fag." There was a tremendous flop in the water just then. We both jumped. "Jesus, what was that?" cried Crumley, peering out over the midnight waters.
"Constance, I thought, coming back."
I stared, and at last said, "Seals. They do come and play out there." There was a series of small flops and splashes which faded as some sea creature departed in darkness. "Hell," said Crumley. "The projector's still running there in the parlor," I said. "Phonographs still playing. Ovens on in the kitchen, something baking. And all the lights in all the rooms."
"Let's shut some off before the damn place burns down."
We followed Constance Radigan's footprints back up to her fortress of white light.
"Hey,"
whispered Crumley. He stared at the eastern horizon.
"What's that?"
There was a faint band of cold light there.
"Dawn,"
I said. I thought it would never come. Constance Radigan's footprints blew away off the sand in the dawn wind. And Mr. Shapeshade came along the shore, looking back over his shoulder, cans of film under his arms. Far off there at this very moment, his movie house was being trashed by huge steel-toothed monsters that had risen, summoned by real estate speculators, out of the sea. When Shapeshade saw me and Crumley standing on Constance Radigan's front porch, he blinked at our faces, and then at the sand, and then at the ocean. We didn't have to tell him anything. Our faces were that pale.
"She'll be back,"
he said again and again.
"She'll be back. Constance wouldn't go away. My God, who would I run films with? Who? She'll be back, sure."
His eyes spilled over. We left him in charge of the empty fort and drove back toward my place. On the way, Detective Lieutenant Crumley, in a burst of invective, using harsh epithets like cow-chapatis, bull durum, bourgeois, and watch out, you'll step in it, refused my offer to go ride on that damn carousel questioning Field Marshal Erwin Rommel or his pretty pal, dressed up in rose petals, Nijinsky.
"In 1 or 2 days, maybe. If that goony old woman doesn't swim back from Catalina, sure. Then I start asking questions. But now, I will not shovel horse flops to find a horse."
"Are you angry with me?" I asked.
"Angry? Angry? Why would I be angry? Angry? Christ, you drive me out of my skull, but angry? Here's a buck. Go buy 10 rides on that Calliope racetrack."
He dropped me, running, at my door, and roared off. Inside, I looked at Cal's old piano. The sheet had fallen off the big white ivory teeth.
"Don't laugh," I said.
3 things happened that afternoon. 2 were fine. 1 was terrible. A letter arrived from Mexico. In it was a photo of Peg. She had colored her eyes with a blend of brown and green ink to help me remember what they looked like. Then there was a postcard from Cal, postmarked Gila Bend. "Son," it said, "you keeping my piano tuned? I'm torturing folks part-time in the local beer joint. This town is full of bald men. Me being here, they don't know how lucky they are. Cut the sheriff's hair yesterday. He gave me 24 hours to leave town. We'll gas up for Sedalia tomorrow. Be happy. Yours, Cal." I turned the car over. There was a photo of a Gila monster with black and white patterns on its back. Cal had drawn a bad portrait of himself, seated there as if the creature were a musical instrument, and him playing only the dark keys. I laughed and walked north toward the Santa Monica Pier, wondering what I might say to that odd man who lived a double life above the moaning carousel. "Field Marshal Rommel," I shouted, "how and why did you set out to kill Constance Radican?" But no one was there to hear. The carousel ran in silence. The calliope was turned on, but the music was at the end of its roll, and the slots flapped around and around. The carousel owner was not dead in his ticket booth, only dead drunk. He was awake, but seemed not to hear the silence, or know that the horses were galloping to the slap of the Swiss cheese roll in the mouth of the big machine. I surveyed it all with disquiet, and was about to trudge upstairs, when I noticed a fine blowing litter on the floor of the circling horse race. I waited for the carousel to turn twice more, then grabbed a brass pole and hopped on, moving drunkenly among the poles. Pieces of torn paper blew in the wind, made by the horses jumping up and down, and the passage of the carousel itself, going nowhere. I found a thumbtack on the circular floor, under the ripped paper. Someone had perhaps tacked the message to the forelock of one of the wooden horses. Someone had found it, read it, torn it, run away. John Wilkes Hopwood. I spent a good 3 minutes picking up the pieces, feeling as hopeless as the carousel's journey, then hopped off and tried piecing it together. It took another 15 minutes of finding a terrible word here, an awful word there, and a damning word further on, but finally there was a death and a doom. Anyone reading this, anyone that is, with the wrong old skeleton hung inside his young, bright flesh, might wither at these strikes to the groin. I could not put it all together. There were missing pieces. But the essence was that the reader was an old man, ugly man, truly ugly. He made love to that body because with that face, who would want him? Nobody, for years. It recalled how the studios threw him out in 1929, attacked the fake kraut voice and broken wrists and strange boyfriends and old sick women. In bars late at night they say your name and laugh at you when you go away full of cheap gin, and now you have caused death. I saw you on the beach last night when she swam out and did not come back. People will say murder. Good night, sweet prince. That was it. A dreadful weapon, posted and found. I gathered the pieces and went upstairs, about 90 years older than I had been a few days before. The door to Hopwood's room whispered open under my hand. There were clothes all over the place, on the floor and by several suitcases, as if he had tried to pack, panicked, and gone off traveling light. I looked out the apartment window. Down on the pier, his bike was still padlocked against a lamppost, but his motorbike was gone, proving nothing. He might have driven rather than walked into the sea. Christ, I thought, what if he catches up with Annie Oakley, and then the two of them catch up with Cal? I dumped a small wastebasket out on a flimsy desk by his bed and found some torn bits of fine bright yellow Beverly Hills-type stationery with CR for Constance Radigan along the top. There was typewriting on the paper. "Midnights. Wait. 6 nights running on the shoreline. Maybe, just maybe, like old times." And the typed initials, CR. The typeface looked like the machine I had seen open on a desk in her Arabian parlor. I touched the fragments, thinking, had Constance written Hopwood? No, she would have told me. Someone else must have sent this to Hopwood a week ago, and he had jogged up the shore like a stallion to wait in the surf for Constance to come laughing down. Had he gotten tired of waiting, and dragged her in the water and drowned her? No, no. He must have seen her dive in and never come out. Scared, he ran home. To find what? The last note. The one with the terrible words and awful degradations that shot him below the belt. So he had two reasons to leave town, fright and the insults. I glanced at the telephone and sighed. No use calling Crumley, no corpus delicti, just torn paper which I shoved in my jacket pockets. They felt like moth wings, fragile, but poisonous. Melt all the guns, I thought. Break the knives, burn the guillotines, and the malicious will still write letters that kill. I saw a small bottle of cologne near the phone and took it, remembering Blind Henry and his memory and his nose. Downstairs, the carousel still turned in silence. The horses still leaped over invisible barriers toward finish lines that never arrived. I glanced at the drunken ticket man in his coffin booth, shivered, and to absolutely no music whatsoever, got the hell out of there. The miracle came just after lunch. A special delivery letter arrived from the American Mercury, offering to buy a short story if I wouldn't mind their sending a check for $300. Mind, I shrieked. Mind! Good grief, they must be nuts! I stuck my head out into the empty street and yelled at the houses, the sky, and the shore. I just sold to the American Mercury! $300! I'm rich! I lurched over to shove the Mercury letter under the bright glass eyes in the small shop window. Look, I cried. How about that? See? Rich, I muttered and gasped as I ran to the liquor store to flap the letter in the owner's face. Look, I waved it around in the Venice train ticket office. Hey, I jolted to a halt, for I discovered I had jumped into the bank, thinking I had the actual check with me and was about to deposit the damn letter. Rich. I blushed and backed off. At my apartment, I suddenly remembered the nightmare, that dire beast rising to seize and eat me. Idiot! Fool! You shouted good rice when it should have been bad.
That night, for the first night in a long while, the small rainstorm did not drench my doormat. There was no visitor, no seaweed on my sidewalk at dawn. Somehow my truth, my blundering yells, had scared it away. Curiouser, I thought, and curiouser. There was no body, and so no funeral the next day, just a memorial service for Constance Radigan that seemed to have been organized by a rat pack of autograph and film photo fans. So there was a mob of milling extras stomping the sand out front of Constance Radigan's Arabian fort on the shore. I stood a long way off from the stampede and watched some aging lifeguards sweat a portable organ across the sands to where someone had forgotten the stool, so the lady who played it badly played it standing up, beads of salt on her brow, bobbing her head to conduct the lugubrious choir as the gulls flew down to investigate a scene without food, so they flew away, and a fake minister barked and yipped like a poodle, and the sandpipers rushed away frightened, as the sand crabs dug deeper to hide, and I gritted my teeth halfway between outrage and demon laughter, as one by one the various grotesques come down off the night screen at Mr. Shapeshade's, or out from under the midnight piers, staggered down to the surf, and hurled withered flower garlands at the tide. Damn it, Constance, I thought. Swim in now. Stop this damn freak show. But my magic thinking failed. The only thing that came in was the wreaths, upchucked by a tide that didn't want them. A few people tried to throw them back again, but the damn things simply returned, and it began to rain. There was a frantic search for newspapers to protect their heads, and the lifeguards grunted the damn organ back across the sand. And I was left alone in the rain with a newspaper draped over my skull and the headlines upside down over my eyes. Famed silent star vanishes. I went down to kick the floral wreaths into the surf.
This time they stayed. Stripped down to my swimsuit, I grabbed an armload of flowers and swam out as far as I could before I let go. Coming back, I almost drowned when my feet caught, tangled in one of the wreaths. "Bromley," I whispered, and did not know if his name on my lips was a curse or a prayer. Crumley opened his door. His face was bright and shining, but not with beer. Something else had happened. "Hey," cried the detective, "where have you been? I've been calling and calling you. Christ, come see what the old man's got." He ran ahead to his workroom and pointed dramatically at his desk, where a pile of manuscript, half an inch high, lay filled with words. "Why, you old S.O.B.," I said, and whistled. "That's me, S.O.B. Crumley. Crumley, S.O.B., boy howdy." He ripped a page out of the typewriter. "Want to read?" "I don't have to," I laughed. "It's good, right?" "Get out of the way," he laughed back. "The dam has broke." I sat down, snorting with happiness at the sun in his face. When did all this happen? 2 nights ago. Midnight, 1, 2, I don't know. I was just lying here with my teeth in my mouth, staring at the ceiling. Not reading a book, not listening to any radio, not drinking beer. And the wind blew outside, and the trees shook. And all of a sudden, the damn idea seethed like maggots on a hot plate. And I just got the hell up and walked over and sat down, and next thing I know, I'm typing, and typing like hell, and can't stop. And by dawn, there's a big mountain, or molehill, of stuff. And I'm laughing and crying all the time. Look at that. And come 6 in the morning, I go to bed and just lie there looking at all this paper. And I laugh and laugh. And I'm as happy as if I'd just had a brand new love affair with the greatest lady in the world. "You had," I said softly. "Funny thing is," said Crumley, "what started it? Maybe the wind outside the house. Somebody leaving seaweed calling cards on the porch. But did the old detective rush out, firing guns, yelling, 'Freeze'? Hell no. No yells, no shots. Just me banging my typewriter, making lots of noise like on New Year's or Halloween. And you know what happened next? Guess." My body was cold. A whole population of frosted bumps had come up on my neck. "The wind went away," I said. "The footsteps outside your house stopped." "What?" said Crumley, amazed. "And there's been no seaweed ever again. And he, whoever he was, has not come back since." "How do you know that?" gasped Crumley. "I just did, is all. You did the right thing without knowing. Just like me. I shouted. And he went away from me, too. Oh, God, God." I told Crumley about my sail to the Mercury, my running around town like a fool, my yelling to the sky, and the rain not raining on my 3 o'clock in the morning door anymore. Maybe forever. Crumley sat down as if I had handed him an anvil. "We're getting close, Elmo," I said. "We've scared him off without meaning to. The further away he gets, the more we know about him. Well, maybe, anyway. At least we know he's put off by loud fools and laughing detectives doing maniac things to typewriters at 5 in the morning. Keep typing, Crumley. Then you'll be safe." "Horseradish," said Crumley, but he laughed when he said it. His smile made me brave. I dug in my pockets and brought out the poison pen letter that had scared Hopwood, plus the warm love letter on sun yellow paper that had lured him down the coast in the first place. Crumley toyed with the bits and pieces and sank halfway back into his old bathrobe of cynicism. "Each typed on a different typewriter. Neither signed. Hell, anyone could have typed both. And if old Hopwood was the sex freak we took him for, he read that one on yellow paper and really believed Rattigan wrote it. Hell, he raced up the shore and waited like a good boy for her to come down and grab his behind. But you know and I know, Rattigan never wrote a note like that in her life. She had an ego like a 10-ton truck. She never begged in the big Hollywood houses, on the streets, or on the shore. So what does that leave us with? She swam at strange hours. I'd run along the beach, my workout, and see that night after night. Anyone, even me, could have snuck in while she was 200 yards out in the bay playing with the sharks. Anyone could have sat in her parlor, used her typewriter and stationery,
and snuck back out, mailed this four-play sex note to that Hopwood son of a bitch, and waited for the fireworks.
And? I said.
And, said Crumley, maybe the whole thing backfired. Radigan, bugged by the flasher, panicked, swam out to escape him, got caught in a riptide. Then Hopwood on the shore, watching, waiting, turned chicken when she didn't swim back in, and fled. The next day he gets the second note, the real doomsday attack. He knows someone saw him on the beach and can finger him as Radigan's so-called killer. So?
He's left town already, I said.
It figures. Which leaves us still 10 miles up from Tampico and Cleopatra's barge with no paddles. What in hell do we have to go on?
A guy who makes phone calls and steals Scott Joplin's head off Cal the Barber's old photo and scares Cal out of town.
Check. A guy who stands in halls and gets an old man drunk and stuffs him in a lion cage and maybe saves some ticket punch confetti stolen from the old man's pockets.
Check.
A guy who scares the old canary lady to death and steals the newspaper headlines from the bottom of her bird cages. And after Fanny stops breathing, the same guy steals her record of Tosca as a keepsake. And then he writes letters to old actor Hopwood and frightens him away forever. Probably stole something from Hopwood's apartment, too, but we'll never know. And if you checked, probably swiped a bottle of champagne from Constance Radigan's wine racks just before I got there the other night. The guy can't stop himself. He's a real collector.
Crumley's telephone rang. He picked it up, listened, handed it to me.
Armpits, said a mellow voice.
Henry!
Crumley put his ear to the receiver with me. Armpits is back, messing around. 2 hours ago, said Henry. Off in that other country, the tenement far across Los Angeles in a rapidly dying past. Someone got to stop him. Who?
Henry hung up.
Armpits. I took Hopwood's springtime cologne out of my pocket and placed it on Crumley's desk.
Nope, said Crumley.
Whoever that badass is in the tenement ain't Hopwood. The old actor always smelled like a bed of marigolds and an acre of stardust. You want me to go sniff around to your friend Henry's door?
No, I said. By the time you got there, Mr. Armpits would be back out here, waiting to snuffle around your door or mine.
Not if we type and shout, shout and type. You forget that?
Hey, what was it you shouted?
I told Crumley more about my American Mercury story sale and the $1 billion that came with it.
Jesus, said Crumley. I feel like a pa whose boy has just made it through Harvard.
Tell me again, kid. How do you do it?
What should I do?
Throw up in your typewriter every morning.
Yeah.
Clean up every noon.
Yeah.
The foghorn out in the bay started blowing, saying over and over in a long, gray voice, Constance Radigan would never come back. Crumley started typing, and I drank my beer. That night, at 1:10, someone came and stood outside my door. Oh, Jesus, I thought, awake. Please, not again. There was a fierce bang, and a hard bang. And then a terrible bang on my door. Someone out there was asking to get in.
God. Coward, I thought. Get it over with. Now, at last, I jumped up to fling the door wide.
You look great in those lousy, torn jockey shorts, said Constance Radigan.
I grabbed and yelled, Constance!
Who in hell would it be?
But I went to your funeral.
So did I. Hell, it's Tom Sawyer time. All those bimbos on the beach and the crappy organ. Shove your ass in your pants. We gotta get out of here. Jump!
Gunning the engine of an old beat-up Ford V8, Constance made me fast zip my fly. Driving south along the sea, I kept mourning, You're alive.
Hold the funeral and wipe your nose.
She laughed at the empty road ahead.
Jesus God, I fooled everyone.
But why? Why?
Well, crud, honey, that bastard kept combing the surf line night after night.
You didn't write. I mean, invite him to...
Invite? Jesus, you got no taste.
She braked the car in behind her shut Arabian fort, lit a cigarette, puffed smoke out the window, glared.
All clear?
He's never coming back, Constance.
Good. He looked better every night. When you're 110 years old, it's not the man, it's the pants. Besides, I thought I knew who he was.
You were right.
So I decided to fix things for good. I stashed groceries in a bungalow south of here and parked this Ford there. Then I came back.
She jumped out of the old Ford and led me to the back door of her house.
I turned on all the lights, music, fixed food that night, opened every door and window, and when he showed up, ran down, yelled, "Beat you to Catalina," and dove in. He was so stunned he didn't follow, or he might have part way and given up. I swam out 200 yards and lay easy. I saw him on the shore the next half hour, waiting for me to come in. Then he ran like hell. I had really spooked him. I swam south and surfed in by my old El Cheapo bungalow near Playa del Rey. I had a ham sandwich and champagne on the porch, feeling great. Hid there ever since. Sorry to worry you, kid. You okay? Give me a kiss, but no phys ed.
She kissed me and unlocked the door, and we walked through to open the beachfront door and let the wind haunt the curtains and sift sand on the tiles.
Jesus, who the hell lived here? She wondered. I'm my own ghost come home. I don't own this anymore. You ever feel, back from vacation, all the furniture, books, radio, seem like neglected cats, resentful? They cut you dead. Feel? It's a morgue.
We walked through the rooms. The furniture, white sheeted in the dust and wind, moved restlessly, perturbed. Constance leaned out the front door and yelled,
"Okay, son of a bitch, gotcha!"
She turned back.
"Find some more champagne. Lock up. Place gives me the creeps. Out."
Only the empty shore and the empty house saw us drive away.
"How about this?"
yelled Constance, Rattigan against the wind. She had put the top of her Ford down, and we drove in a warm, cold flood of night, our hair blowing. And we pulled up in a great sluice of sand next to a little bungalow by a half-tumbled wharf, and Constance was out shucking clothes down to her bra and pants. The embers of a small fire burned in the front yard sands. She stoked it with kindling and paper, and when it flared, shoved some forked hot dogs into it and sat knocking my knees like a teenage ape, drinking the champagne and tousling my hair.
"See that hunk of driftwood there? All that's left of the Diamond Dance Pier, 1918. Charlie Chaplin sat at a table there. D.W. Griffith beyond. Me and Desmond Taylor at the far end. Wally Beery. Well, why go on? Burn your mouth. Heat."
She stopped suddenly and looked north along the sands.
"They won't follow, will they? He or they or them or whatever. They didn't see us, did they? We're safe forever."
"Forever," I said. The salt wind stirred the fire. Sparks flew up to shine in Constance Radigan's green eyes. I looked away. "There's just one last thing I have to do."
"What?"
"Tomorrow, around 5, go in and clean out Fanny's icebox." Constance stopped drinking and frowned.
"Why would you want to do that?"
"I had to think of something so as not to spoil the champagne night. A friend of mine, Streeter Blair, the artist, used to win blue ribbons at the county fair every autumn with his baked bread. After he died, they found 6 loaves of his bread in his home freezer. His wife gave me one. I had it around for a week and ate a slice with real butter once in the morning, once at night. God, it was swell. What a great way to say goodbye to a wonderful man. When I buttered the last slice, he was gone for good. Maybe that's why I want Fanny's jellies and jams. Okay?" Constance was disquieted.
"Yes,"
she said at last. I popped another cork.
"What do we drink to?"
"My nose," I said. "At last my damn head cold is over. 6 boxes of Kleenex later, to my nose."
"Your lovely big nose,"
she said, and drank. We slept out on the sand that night, feeling safe 2 miles south of those funeral flowers touching the shore by the late Constance Radigan's former Arabian lean-to, and 3 miles south of an apartment where Cal's piano smile and my battered Underwood waited for me to come save Earth from Martians on one page and Mars from Earthmen on the next. In the middle of the night, I awoke. The place next to me on the sand was empty, but still warm from where Constance had lain cuddling the poor writer. I got up to hear her thrashing and chortling with seal bark commotions out in the waves. When she ran in, we finished the champagne and slept until almost noon. That day was one of those no-excuses-needed-for-living weather days, when you just lie and let the juices flow and drip. But finally I had to say, I didn't want to ruin last night. God, it was good to find you alive. But the truth is, it's one down, one to go. Mr. Devil in the Flesh on the beach ran away because he thought he had caused you to drown. He never intended anything but skin diving anyway, and midnight frolics, like 1928. What he got was you drowned, it seemed. So he's gone. But there's still the one who sent him. Jesus, whispered Constance. Her eyelids flinched like two spiders over her shut eyes. At last she sighed, exhausted. So it's not over after all. I clenched her sand-gritty hand in mine. After a long, silent time of thinking, she said, her eyes still shut, about Fanny's icebox. I never made it back that night, 5 centuries ago, to look in. You looked, saw nothing. That's why I've got to go look again. Trouble is, the law has padlocked her apartment. You want me to go jimmy the lock? Constance, I'll go in, clear the halls, chase out the spooks. You hit him with a club, then we both crack the padlock, spoon Fanny's mayonnaise, and at the bottom of the third jar we find the answer, the solution, if it's still there, if it hasn't spoiled or been taken away. A fly buzzed, touched my brow. An old notion stirred. Reminds me, that story years ago in some magazine, girl fell and froze in a glacier. 200 years later, the ice melts, and there she is, beautiful, young as the day she was frozen. That's no beautiful girl in Fanny's fridge. No. It's something terrible. And when and if you find and take whatever it is out, do you kill it? 9 times, I guess. Yeah. 9 should do it. How, said Constance, her face pale under her tan, does that damn first aria from Tosca go? I got out of her car in front of the tenement, just at dusk. The night looked even darker just inside the waiting hall. I stared at it for a long moment. My hands trembled on the door of Constance Radigan's roadster. Want old Ma to come in with you? She said. Good grief, Constance. Sorry, kid. She patted my cheek, gave me a kiss that made my eyelids fly up like window shades, handed me a piece of paper, and shoved. That's my bungalow phone, listed under the name Trixie Fraganza, the I Don't Care girl. Remember her? No. Nuts. If someone kicks your bung downstairs, yell. If you find the bastard, form a conga line and throw him off the second floor porch. You want me to wait here? Constance, I moaned. Down the hill she found a red light and went through it. I came up the stairs to a hall that was dark forever. The light bulbs had been stolen years ago. I heard someone run. It was a very light tread like a child's. I froze, listening. The footsteps diminished and ran down the steps at the rear of the tenement. The wind blew down the hall and brought the smell with it. It was the scent that Henry had told me about, of clothes that had hung in an attic for 100 years and shirts that had been worn for 100 days. It was like standing in a midnight alley where a pack of hounds had gone to lift their legs with mindless, panting smiles. The smell pulled me into a jumping run. I made it to Fanny's door and braked myself, heart pounding. I gagged because the smell was so strong. He had been here only a few moments ago. I should have run after, but the door itself stopped me. I put out my hand. The door scraped softly inward on unoiled hinges. Someone had broken the lock on Fanny's door. Someone had wanted something. Someone had gone in to search. Now it was my turn. I stepped forward into a dark remembrance of food. The air was pure delicatessen, a warm nest where a great, kind, strange elephant had browsed and sung and eaten for 20 years. How long, I wondered, before the scent of dill and cold cuts and mayonnaise would blow away lost down the tenement stairwells. But now, the room was a ramshackle mess. He had come in and tumbled the shelves and closets and bureaus. Everything was flung to the linoleum floor. All of Fanny's opera scores were strewn among the broken phonograph records that had been kicked against the wall or toppled in his search. "Jesus, Fanny," I whispered. "I'm glad you can't see this." Everything that could have been searched and wrecked was wrecked. Even the great throne chair where Fanny had queened it for half a generation or more was tossed down on its back, as she had been tossed down to stay. But the one place he had not looked, the last place, I looked now. Stumbling on the shambles, I grabbed the icebox door and pulled. The cool air sighed out around my face. I stared as I had stared many nights ago, aching to see what was right there before me. What was the thing the stander in the hall, the stranger on the night train, had come to find but left behind for me? Everything was just as it had always been. Jams, jellies, salad dressings, wilted lettuce, a rich cold shrine of colors and scents where Fanny had worshipped. But suddenly, I sucked my breath. I reached out and shoved the jars and bottles and cheese boxes way to the back. They had been placed all this while on a thin folded paper of some size, which until now I had simply taken as a sheet to catch drippings. I pulled it out and read by the icebox light, "Janus, the Green Envy Weekly." I left the box door wide and staggered over to put Fanny's old chair upright and collapse in it to wait for my heart to slow. I turned the green-tinted newspaper pages. On the back were obits and personals. I ran my eye down, found nothing, ran it down again, and saw a small box circled faintly with red ink. And this was what he had searched for to take away forever. How could I know? Here were the words. "Where have you been all these years? My heart cries out. Does yours? Why don't you write or call? I can be happy if only you'd remember me as I remember you. We had so much and lost it all. Now, before it's too late to remember, find your way back. Call." And it was signed, "Someone who loved you long ago." And in the margin were these words, scrawled by someone, "Someone who loved you with a full heart. Long ago." Jesus at midnight, Mary in the morn. I read it 6 times in disbelief. I let the paper fall, walked on it, stood in the icebox draft to cool off. Then I went back to read the damn message for a 7th time. What a piece of work it was. What a beaut. What a come on. What a baited trap. What a Rorschach test. What a piece of palmistry. What a numbers game that anyone could sum and win with. Men, women, old, young, dark, light, tall, thin. Listen, look, this means you. It applied to anyone who had ever loved and lost, meaning every single soul in the whole damned city, state, and universe. Who, reading it, would not be tempted to lift a phone, dial, wait, and whisper at last, late at night, "Here I am. Please, come find me." I stood in the middle of the linoleum floor of Fanny's apartment and tried to imagine her here, the ship's deck creaking underfoot as her weight shifted this way and that, as Tosca lamented from the phonograph, and the icebox door stood wide with its enshrined condiments, her eyes moving, her heart beating like a hummingbird trapped in a vast aviary. Christ! The 5th horseman of the apocalypse had to be the editor of a paper like this. I checked all the other advertisements. The telephone number was the same in each. You had to call one number to get referrals to all the ads, and that phone number belonged to the publishers of, damn them to hell forever, Janus, the Green Envy Weekly. Fanny had never in her life bought a paper like this. Someone had given it to her, or... I stopped and glanced at the door. No, someone had left it for her to find, with the red ink circling this one ad, so she would be sure to see someone who loved you with a full heart long ago. Fanny, I cried in dismay. Oh, you damn fool. I waded through broken shards of La Boheme and Butterfly, then remembered and stumbled back to slam the icebox door. Things were no better on the third floor. Henry's door was wide open. I had never seen it open before. Henry believed in shut doors. He didn't want anyone having a sighted advantage on him. But now... Henry? I stepped through, and the small apartment was neat, incredibly neat and clean and filed, everything in place, everything fresh, but empty. Henry? His cane lay in the middle of the floor, and by it a dark string, a black twine, with knots in it. It all looked scattered and impromptu, as if Henry had lost these in a fight, or left behind when he ran. Where? Henry? I handled the twine and looked at the knots. In a line, two knots, a space. Three knots, a long space. Then a series of three, six, four, and nine knots. Henry! Louder. I ran to knock on Mrs. Gutierrez's door. When she opened it and saw me, she welled over. Tears dropped from her eyes as she saw my face. She put her tortilla-scented hand out to touch my cheeks. Oh, poor, poor. Come in, oh, poor. Sit down. Sit. You want to eat? I bring something. Sit. No, sit. Coffee, yes? She brought me coffee and wiped her eyes. Poor Fanny. Poor man. What? I unfolded the newspaper and held it out for her to see. No read inglese, she said, backing off. Don't have to read, I said. Did Fanny ever come up to phone and bring this paper with her? No. Her face changed color with memory. Estúpido, sí, she came, but I don't know who she called. Did she talk a long while? A long time? Long time? She had to translate my words for a few seconds. Then she nodded vigorously. Si, long. Long she laugh. Oh, how she laugh and talk and laugh. While she was inviting Mr. Night and Time and Eternity to come over, I thought. And she had this paper with her? Mrs. Gutierrez turned the paper over like it was a Chinese puzzle. Maybe she, maybe no. This one, some other, I don't know. Fanny is with God. I turned, weighing 380 pounds, and leaned toward the door, the folded newspaper in my hands. I wish I were, I said. Please, may I use your phone? On a hunch, I did not dial the Green Envy number. Instead, counting the knots, I dialed the numbers of Blind Henry's twine.
Janus Publications, said a nasal voice. Green Envy, hold.
The phone was dropped to the floor. I heard heavy feet shuffling through wintry mounds of crumpled paper.
It fits,
I yelled, and scared Mrs. Gutierrez, who jumped back.
The number fits.
I yelled at the Green Envy paper in my hand. For some reason, Henry had knotted the Janus Publications number onto his remembrance twine.
Hello? Hello?
I shouted. Far off in the Green Envy office, I could hear some maniac shrieking because he was trapped and electrocuted by a bin of wildly berserk guitars. A rhinoceros and two hippos were dancing a fandango in the latrine to rebut the music. Someone typed during the cataclysm. Someone else was playing a harmonica to a different drummer. I waited 4 minutes, then jammed the phone down and stormed out of Mrs. Gutierrez's, raving.
Mister,
said Mrs. Gutierrez,
Why are you so upset?
Upset? Upset? Who's upset? I cried. Christ, people don't come back to phones. I got no money to get out to that damn place, wherever it is in Hollywood, and there's no use calling back. The damn phone's off the hook, and time's running out. And where the hell is Henry? He's dead, damn it.
Not dead, Mrs. Gutierrez should have said. Merely sleeping. But she didn't say, and I thanked her for her silence, and stormed down the hallway, not knowing what to do. I didn't even have money for the stupid red trolley car to Hollywood.
Henry!
I shouted down the stairwell.
Yes, said a voice behind me.
I whirled around.
I yelled. There was nothing but darkness there. Henry, is that...
Me, said Henry, and stepped out into what little light there was. When Henry decides to hide, he truly hides. Holy Moses Armpits was here. I think he knows that we know what he knows about this mess. I just skedaddled out my apartment door when I heard him prowl the porch outside my view window. I just dropped and jumped. Left stuff, I don't care, on the floor. You find it?
Yes, your cane, and the string with knots for numbers.
You want to know about them knots, that number?
Yes.
I hide crying in the hall day before Fanny's gone forever. There she is at my door. I open it to let all that sadness in. Not often I see her upstairs. It kills her to climb.
I shouldn't have done it, no. Shouldn't have done it, she says. All my fault, she says, over and over.
Watch this junk, Henry. Take this junk here. What a fool I am, she says. And she gave me some old phonograph records and some newspapers. Specials, she said. And I thanked her and thought, what the hell? And she went down the hall crying for herself, being a fool. And I just put the old newspapers by, and the records, and didn't think a long while till after Fanny was tributed, and sung after, and gone. And then this morning, I ran my hand over those fool papers and thought, what is this? And I called Mrs. Gutierrez and said, what? And in Mexican and English, she looked over the paper and saw the words. You see them, circled in ink, the same words in five different issues of the paper, and the same number. And I got to thinking, why was Fanny crying so hard? And what's this number? So I knotted the knots and called. You call?
Yes, Henry, I said. I found the same paper in Fanny's place now. Why didn't you tell me you had them?
What for? Sounded foolish. Woman stuff. I mean, did you read it? Mrs. Gutierrez read it. Bad, but read it out loud. I laughed. God, I thought, that's trash. Real trash. Only now I think different. Who would read and believe junk like that?
Fanny, I said at last.
Tell me this now. When you called that number, some dumb son of a bitch come on, talk, and not come back again ever?
Some son of a bitch. Henry started steering me back toward the open door of his apartment. As if I were the blind one, I let him.
How they run a business like that, he wondered.
We were at his door. I said, I guess when you don't give a damn, people throw money at you.
Yeah, that was always my trouble. I cared too much, so nobody ever threw nothing. Hell, I got plenty of cash anyway. Ugh.
He stopped, for he had heard me suck my breath.
That, he said with a quiet nod and smile, is the sound of someone wants to borrow my life savings.
Only if you come with, Henry, to help me find the guy who hurt Fanny.
Armpits?
Armpits.
This nose is yours. Lead on.
We need money for a taxi cab to save time, Henry.
I've never been in a taxi in my life. Why would I take one now?
We got to get out to that newspaper before it closes. The sooner we find out what we need to know, the safer it'll be.
I don't want to spend one more night worrying about you here in this tenement, or me at the beach.
Armpits has teeth, huh?
You'd better believe it.
Come on. He circled his room, smiling. Let's find where a blind man hides his money. All over the place. You want $80?
Hell no.
$60? $40? $20, $30
will do.
Well, hell then.
Henry snorted, stopped, laughed, and yanked a great wad of bills out of his hip pocket. He began to peel the lettuce.
Here's $40.
It'll take a while to pay it back.
If we get whoever pushed Fanny over, you don't owe nothing.
Grab the money. Find McCain. Shut the door. Come on. Let's go find that dumb bunny who answers phones and goes off on vacation.
In the taxicab, Henry beamed around at sources of scent and odor he could not see.
This is dandy. I never smelled a cab before. This one's new and going fast.
I couldn't resist. Henry, how do you save up so much?
I don't see 'em, touch 'em, even smell 'em, but I play the horses. Got friends at the track. They listen and lay on the lettuce. I bet more and lose less than most sighted fools. It mounts up. When it gets too big, I trot along to one of those ugly ladies, so they tell me, in the bungalows out front near the tenement. They say ugly, but I don't mind. Blind is blind, and... Well now, where are we?
Here, I said. We had pulled into an alley behind a building in a run-down block in Hollywood south of the boulevard. Henry snuffed a deep breath.
It ain't armpits, but it's his first cousin. Watch out.
I'll be right back. I got out. Henry stayed in the back seat, his cane in his lap, eyes restfully shut.
I'll just listen to the meter, he said, and make sure it don't run fast.
The dusk was long since gone, and it was full night as I picked my way along the alley, looking up at a half-lit neon sign on the back stairs of a building with the great god Janus painted facing two ways above it. Half of one face had flaked off in the rains. The rest would be soon gone. Even the gods, I thought, are having a bad year. I dodged upstairs among various young men and women with old faces, hunched like beaten dogs, smoking, begging their pardon, excusing myself, but nobody seemed to mind. I stepped in at the top. The offices looked as if they hadn't been cleaned since the Civil War. There was paper balled, wadded, tossed over every inch, foot, and yard of the floor. There were hundreds of old newspapers, crumpled and yellowing, in the windows, on the desktops. Three wastebaskets stood empty. Whoever had thrown the paper wads had missed 10,000 times. I waded in through a tide that reached my ankles. I walked on dried cigars, cigarette stubs, and by the crackling sound of their small thoraxes, cockroaches. I found the abandoned phone under a snow-piled desk, picked it up, listened. I thought I could hear the traffic going by under Mrs. Gutierrez's window. Crazy, she must have hung up long ago. Thanks for waiting, I said.
Hey, man, what gives? Said someone.
I hung up and turned. A tall, skinny man with a clear drop of water on the end of his thin nose came wading through the paper tide. He sized me up with nicotine-stained eyes. I called about half an hour ago. I nodded at the phone. I just hung up on me. He gazed at the phone, scratched his head, and finally got it. He managed a feeble smile and said,
Shit!
Those are my very thoughts. I had a feeling he was proud of never coming back to the phone. It was better to make up your own news.
Hey, man,
he said, getting another idea to replace the first. He was the sort of thinker who has to move out the furniture before he can bring in the cows. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.